Good to see everybody. Good morning. And yeah, by the way, since Bobby likes to throw me under the bus for being a former New Yorker, in my defense, the moment I was old enough to know better, I moved here. So I
too late. Just,
God is sovereign, and He called me into existence with no counsel from me in New York. So I, you know. All right, but here we are in chapter 6 of Ecclesiastes, what is wealth really worth? I hope you guys are having a wonderful morning, and it is just a blessing to be here. I pray that the Lord blesses this study, and that He's glorified in it, and we're all edified and capable of and empowered to apply these truths, these principles to our lives. So, you know, here we go. We're chapter 6, what is wealth really worth? We finished chapter 5 with it, how it's a blessing to be able to enjoy the toil and the work of our hands. And here we pick up verse 1. There's an evil that I've seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor, so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God does not give him power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. To introduce a discussion on the value of riches with the statement, there is an evil, ought to help us understand the context of wealth in God's world. You know, when we first started this a couple months ago now, I can't believe it's... My mother used to say, when you get older, time goes faster. And I thought that was just a really old person talking. But I think there's more truth to that than I am comfortable with. So when we first started this, I said that you can really look at Ecclesiastes as almost being an expository sermon on Jesus speaking about where our hearts are and our treasure in Matthew. And so here's an evil, and it ought to help us understand the context of wealth in God's world. Like this sermon this morning is that God is sovereign. He's sovereign over Caesar Augustus. He's sovereign over everything that we're doing now, and including our wealth, including the type of wealth that we are able to accumulate. Remember, the land of a rich man produced bountifully. We could work really, really hard, and it just may not turn out for our benefit the way we want to. As a small business owner, I can't tell you how many times I thought, well, I'm going to do this, and I'm pretty sure this is going to work pretty well, and it didn't. And in other areas where I thought, well, this is sort of a dud, and I look at that and chuckle and think, well, the Lord is really keeping me humble. And I think that that's one of the overriding issue in Ecclesiastes is God's sovereignty. So, and we are again to read under the sun. Once again, we hear, there's an evil that I've seen under the sun. This means that we're talking about men who put their trust and confidence in earthly possessions. But remember, this is a congregation. The preacher calls Kohelet, pulls everybody in and says, okay, so he's talking to Israelites. He's talking to the covenant people of God. And so there are covenant people in our church, and this is us, who may be putting our trust in wealth. During the COVID era, I remember when the gyms reopened and so forth, everywhere I went, I had to take my temperature. I'm quite politically a little bit libertarian, which is why I got out of New York State as fast as I could. Even putting a seatbelt on because somebody told me to irritates me. I don't like having to do anything somebody told me to do. You could call that the flesh, but and I do, by the way, just for the record, especially since I'm being recorded here. Just for the record, and Jim Leathers is not back there either. So. But now here we have this case of our trust and confidence in earthly possessions, and if you're telling me that, okay, well, I'm going to be happy and safe and so forth, and yet I have to do these other things here, is that we are going to be in under the sun. We are going to either worship the true and living God and have our hearts transformed by Him, or we're going to be pursuing these other things. And as we just saw with the Chick-fil-A story out of New York, that's not because the state senator, I forget his name, wants New York State to have rest stops with chicken for sale on Sunday. He's very pro LGBTQ, and he therefore there's a bullseye on Chick-fil-A, and that's what he's going after them for. He's more concerned with earthly possessions. This is the kingdom, and so it's under the sun is again here for us in that regard. And we want power, right? We want control and security. So where is our treasure? What do we really want? And that's the case here. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God doesn't give him the power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. And this is a case where the language is pretty strong of not just a stranger, but like an alien, and a person coming in from another country. Maybe it's, you know, in judgment where you have a person from a foreign country or another family or something of they didn't work for it at all, and they get it. So the verse here is very powerful, and it reminds us that it's God who gives all gifts. It's God who gives all gifts. No one may rightly say, I did this. Right? I mean, so you see this in government all the time. And I've referenced this before when former President Obama said, you didn't build that. And in that regard, I completely agree with him. But remember, we do not have a culture war. We have a theology war of who's sovereign, the state or God. And that's what we have. It is God who gives all gifts. And for we can do nothing unless it's granted to us from above. And the ongoing theology war manifests itself with, as again from a sermon this morning, is that a lot of times our rulers make rulings and decrees that are very vexing to us, and they should be, but they should never be. They should never lead us to despair. They should never lead us to an utter sense of hopelessness, because we know over them, over the Caesar Augustuses of our time, there is a higher judge. So furthermore, it is God alone who gives us the power to enjoy things, and this is directly related to those who seek him in spirit and in truth. Why? Because this is his world, right? And the pursuit of happiness on our own terms is both irrational and sinful. We're prone not to look at it this way. We're prone to think of sinful as something, you know, that's in and of itself we shouldn't be doing. But think about this. It's like the separation of the two, of this is sinful, but it's not necessarily irrational. In modern America, most people will think of Christians as being of people of the faith, which are not people of the mind. That's not biblical, and it's very, very bad philosophy. For example, all sin is illogical. It puts my pleasure at the center of the universe. Sin is looking at the world that we didn't create. As I said earlier, I was called into existence. I had nothing to say about it. I was just born, right? I saw on YouTube the other day while I was doing something, you know, social media knows what you've been looking at, so it suggests these things, right? It's getting a little bit creepy. I was talking to my wife about something, and then later I saw an ad on one of my things for that. I'm thinking, wow, you know, every idle word, apparently. It had the renewed footage of Super Bowl V, Cowboys and Colts, where the Colts won in a last-second field goal in a turnover fest in Miami, Florida, and the Cowboys wore the blue uniforms. I grew up, the first Super Bowl I remember was Super Bowl X, 1976, January 76. Now, why am I bringing this up? Is because I was a baby during the Super Bowl V. I'm pretty sure I was in diapers. I don't have any recollection of it whatsoever. And I'm looking at the footage, restored footage. It's fantastic. And I'm sitting there going, wow, this whole world going on, I have no knowledge of anything happening. All of those souls that were there, that were something so passionate there, so it's a Super Bowl, and where are all these people, right? Nobody cares today. Nothing matters about that. Sin is irrational because it takes temporary things and makes them ultimate and eternal things, right? Does it matter to you that the Colts won that Super Bowl? No, no. Doesn't matter. And it is with every single thing that we're doing under the sun. It is the eternal perspective that, like we saw from the sermon this morning, with Jesus being born in the lowliest of circumstances. We have a tendency in sin to try to make our circumstances the chief end, not God's glory. And that's why it's irrational. It sets us on a collision course with reality. So the preacher continues, this is vanity. It is a grievous evil. Here we go, and it's a grievous evil. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, he also has no burial. I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. There's a subtle distortion of materialism that the preacher hits here that is, I just find it fascinating. It's a subtle distortion of materialism and therefore rebellion against God, and it's the pursuit of happiness in family. And you see this in a lot of movies. It ends up with the family is the main thing. See, we have a big family. We're good with family. It's basically the chief end of every Hallmark Christmas movie. And you can always tell the bad guy in the Hallmark movie because he's wearing a tie and he takes his work too seriously. It's the guy without the tie. Notice I'm not wearing a tie. That has family relationships. He's back to shaking his head. He's family relationships is the key. So it's family is the chief end. Again, we go back to the Shorter Catechism. What is the chief end of man? To glorify God. The preacher says it right at the end of the book. All has been heard, right? This is the end of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments. This is the whole duty of man. This is not hard to understand. It is hard to apply because we are the living sacrifices that keep crawling off the altar and trying to go about our own way. We are convinced that our problem is our circumstances, and we go back to, as I said before, the Bible is never irrational. What it is it's that perfect mirror, as James calls it. And we don't want to see what we really look like. And the preacher is warning us here that these are signs. If we go and get the temperature check, and again, I go back to that. I know I lost it for a second. But I go back and get my temperature check because they're afraid if you had COVID, you had a bad temperature, right? So to get out of the gym or get out of the business. And I didn't like that for my purely irritated part of don't make me do things that I don't want to do. But there's a rationality to the fact if somebody has a temper, if they have a temperature, they may have some type of illness that could be communicable, right? Absolutely. This is what he's saying here in Ecclesiastes 6. If you're struggling with these things, if these things are here in our hearts, that's you have a temperature. And though we could be covenant people of God, we may very well have been infected with greed and envy. And greed and envy are very much the carbon monoxide of sins, not the visible sin of lust or temper, violence, and these other things which would be much more readily apparent to the outsider, but it would kill you just as dead. So this subtle distortion is a person who's got hundreds of children. And we look at this, what a great family. So his days and years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things. He's not satisfied because he's not in the Lord. He's under the sun. You will not be satisfied. You cannot be satisfied outside of the Lord. And if you're finding a consistent case, now all of us are going to find a case where we're not always even, right? We're not always cool. But if it's a systemic issue, you have a fever of greed and envy. And you want to be very careful with that and come to the Word. The silver-winged child is better off than he. Wow. Now, this isn't hyperbole where Jesus says, if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off. Now, we know that from good systematics is that the right hand or the eye or whatever, a body part can't cause us to sin. We sin because it's in our heart. So this is literally, he's saying, a silver-winged child's better off than you. You could add 100 kids, your pursuit of happiness in the name of family and wealth. This is dealt with here by the preacher because what good is a family under the sun? Because we've taken a good thing in the Lord and made it an ultimate thing in the flesh. So it is God who brings joy and peace. It is sin that makes men miserable. Sin is irrational. It's always going to make us miserable. It's always going to keep us unhappy. All forms of self-soteriology, of self-salvation outside of Christ are going to end up making us miserable. Good health and a large family are not in and of themselves good things. In fact, they're acquired to be used for the happiness in the Lord. That's the goal. The goal is never to have these things and go, see, look at me, I'm happy. Or you evaluate your life and go, I've got more money than I did 10 years ago. I must be doing well. Or my kids are all doing well. We must be doing well. They're in good schools. They're good students. In a bumper sticker, I have a terrific kid. Something like that, which is, fine. I'm not saying if you've got that on your car, I'm not busting you. But where is our heart? Again, the heart and treasure. The heart and treasure. We're living in God's world, so if we try to live as if it's not his and everything in it isn't his, we've got a problem. For example, imagine somebody who, a boy and a girl that sneak in someplace where they're not supposed to be. They're trespassing. They're sneaking around dad's room or dad's office. And there's a trepidation to everything they do. Every noise they hear is going to make them do that, right? They're going to freak out. I did that a couple of times with my sister. It wasn't me. It was my sister. She was older, and she was very persuasive. She was Lucy. I've got five reasons, you know, and she would close her fists. So that's why I got into martial arts, by the way, to protect myself and my sister, just for the record. But we would go in, and we were doing things we weren't supposed to do. And every little noise you heard, it just freaked out. Your heart would just start jumping. That is us in sin. We hear the Lord, his moral law, walking in the cool of the day, if I may be so metaphorical with this, and it causes us a panic. So that's why we're not ever going to be settled and joyful and at peace with this. And it's a sign that we have a temperature. It's a sign that the wealth and the envy, we're trying to live in God's world, we're trespassing in his stuff, not giving him thanks. And he'd give us everything. Donald Gray Barnhouse talks about a child who went and stole $5 from his dad's wallet one night because he wanted something. And the father would have given him the money anyway. Look at David when Nathan confronts him. What does he say? It's an interesting thing what he says. Why did you despise the gifts of the Lord? He rattles off a short list, a bullet points list of all the things he blessed him with. Why were you not satisfied, David? Why did you have to have this one thing that you didn't, that I didn't give you? And I would have given you all these other things even better than what you have. What did you do this for? Because sin makes us thankless. Again, the temperature check, sin makes us thankless. And so therefore, we'll never be settled. The preacher goes on, for it comes in vanity and goes in darkness, and in darkness its name is covered. Moreover, it has not seen the sun or known anything, yet it finds rest rather than he. Talking about the stillborn child. The stillborn baby hasn't seen life's many sorrows and is indeed better. Yeah, better than such a sinner who dies without Christ. Or the most impoverished of all people, a covenant believer. A covenant believer who has the billions and billions of dollars in riches in his spiritual account or her spiritual account, picking through the garbage on the street. We see homeless people like that, and it's hard to look. Such is the spiritual state of so many Christians who are living for the world's wealth, and they have turned their back on or ignored the grace that's in their account. There's an unspeakable agony and grief in having one's life end literally upon a sea of miserable circumstances and general unhappiness. Again, he calls it a grievous evil, so let's just pause a moment and think about this. Imagine at the end of your days, and if some of you have known people have had this happen to them, and they have ended. I'll give you the gravest example I know of Joseph Stalin at the end of his life, shaking his fist as he was dying. Not happy. A stillborn child is better off than that. Because all sin is a cosmic war against God to wrest control of that property, his world. I want the blessings of God. I don't want God. That's what's going on. And so, of course, that's going to cause more and more infuriation. Or I'll give you the smallest example. Vodi Bakum calls children, sometimes babies in particular, vipers in diapers. It's like they are the most selfish beings on the planet. You know, I'm cold, he cries, make me warm. I'm hungry, cries, make me, you know, feed me. So that's all you need to know. That's the basic state of humanity. I want. I feel something I want, and you better provide it for me. And so it's a case of power, the acquisition of wealth. When we look at the great evils of dictators and so forth, we mentioned Caesar Augustus this morning with it, having a law against adultery or having a... we do want to play God, and we just don't have enough resources for it or power for it. So we organize and we get all... we have all the conflicts that we have because of it. So the stillborn baby is better, the preacher's saying, because he hasn't had these problems. Because you ended up far more futile at the end of the day with all of these problems in darkness. The bitterness, the rancor, the fist shaking. The stillborn baby doesn't know any of that. I mean, that's a hard truth. That's what I said before about Ecclesiastes is a book for big boys and girls. It's not a bedtime story. It's like, really? Sit down, dude. This is going to be rough. You need to hear this before you leave the house. Proverbs was your general wisdom literature. Here are your common scenarios about the pursuit of wisdom and so forth. But wait, before you leave the house, young fella, get ready. Okay? Get ready. Some of my favorite stories, and I told some of them here, of me growing up. Now, last week, when I mentioned that when I first had a paycheck and went over to my parents' house to grumble and complain about how much money I lost at taxes and how little I had left over after I paid my electric bill and my groceries, and I literally said, I worked all week. I have nothing. And my parents, you'd have thought I was the funniest man and the best comedian that ever walked a planet, because they sat there laughing so hard. And I thought, what did I say? Well, I wasn't that daft. I didn't realize that they were laughing at me because this was, but I didn't like hearing it. I certainly didn't like hearing that laughter, and I would have really appreciated a little bit more compassion. Even though he should live 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good. Once again, it's a subtle form of materialism. Long life. I want a long life and a big family. I don't need a huge house. I don't need a house like the Johnsons or the Smiths have. I just want a big enough house. I want a house to entertain. Now, my wife does like throwing her under the bus. She does watch Hallmark movies, and she does watch HGTV. What catches me about HGTV stuff, incidentally, is how few people I've seen there break down and cry and thank the Lord. Maybe they edit it out when they get a house like this. Right. I mean, the Thanksgiving that should be pouring out. If we don't think mankind, as Dostoevsky said, should be referred to as the ungrateful biped, we are monstrously ungrateful. If you don't think that we have an ingratitude, thanklessness problem, watch HGTV. I want room to, you know. And plus, the other thing is, some of these people are like 22, 23 years old, and they've got like an $800,000 budget for a house. And I'm watching this going, is this a joke? I do not have that kind of house. My first apartment, I had to, you know, shimmy down the hall. Anyway, enough about me. And I'm not grumbling and complaining. Just pointing out the obvious disparity of wealth, of which I'm not happy with. But joking. But we are not going to be happy unless we're thankful to God. Thanksgiving passes, and everybody's talking about thanks. I'm being thankful. And I love my atheist friends when I say to them, what are you thankful to? What? Gas? Air? What? You're going to be thankful to someone. That's what fills our hearts with joy. And even if you live 1,000 years twice over, and you have a huge family and a nice enough house, so what? Ready? Here he goes. He lowers the boom again. Don't all go to one place. The dude living in a shack someplace. You're going to die. He's going to die. You're all going to die. And that's just a fact. Just a fact. No matter what you do, no matter what you achieve, no matter what title you get, no matter where you go, no matter if you're the GM of something or you're the lowliest person on a totem pole, doesn't matter. You're going to die. And that's not an insult. Not God being mad and saying, oh, you're going to die. No, this is a fact. And in loving, remember the preacher's calling a congregation together. He's calling his covenant people. Man, you're going to die. Live backwards, as David Gibson says. We know where you're going. You best look at this and organize your life that way. Don't all go to one place. Once again, the preacher reminds us of the big truth. Even if our death's delayed many years, it's still there. Still there. And then what do we do if somebody gets cut down in the prime of their life? You ever think about that from the biblical perspective? So if you, again, my mother died fairly early. She walked 2 miles a day. She had a great diet. She didn't smoke. Leukemia caught her. She's dead at 69. My dad? No. My dad didn't walk. My dad chain smoked. My dad didn't get any exercise except for walking from the golf cart to the ball, hit the ball, back to the golf cart right after the ball. That's the exercise my dad got by the end of his life. And he outlived her by almost a good 10 years. Right? And if you've seen that, you've seen people who metaphorically can almost play in traffic and they're like bulletproof. And other people just get cut down. the preacher's saying they're all going to one place. And in the cosmic scheme of things, where's Caesar Augustus? Where is he at? Right? I have a Caesar salad. Big deal. Caesar doesn't, I can make fun of Caesar all day long, and I'm not going to end up on a cross. Because if people say times change, God doesn't. We all will stand before the judgment seat of Christ. That's been the thing about death. It's not just the fact of death. This is a Christian truth because we all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. Romans 14, speaking on this, and Paul mentions it in Corinthians as well. A quick point about this, about death, that this is not fatalism. This is Christian truth. Every one of us is going to give an account. Now, the Bible speaks, James Montgomery Boyce talks about 7 different judgments. For example, the judgment of the nations, the judgment of unbelievers, the great white throne judgment, the judgment of the beast and the false prophet, the judgment of Satan. The judgment of believers is separate. No condemnation. There's none. Romans 8:1 hits it hard. It comes out and it goes, none, zero, no condemnation. The Lord Jesus Christ cannot be condemned, so neither can you who are in him. God the Father would sooner reject Jesus Christ than reject you who are in him. Do not forget that as we approach this subject. He will not lose you. This is also to say that in the judgment you will give an account. You will give an account. James Montgomery Boyce mentions it this way. Have you sat down? Give an account. Write a quick paragraph. He says, I was born to a godly family, in a God-fearing family with good godly mentors. I was aware of and prepared for ministry my whole life. That was my education, and my every thought was directed towards that path. And so then I'm the pastor of 10th Presbyterian downtown Philadelphia, an urban ministry, and we are doing this, this, and this to the glory of God in this ministry. This is what I've been given. You will give an account. What will it be? When you look at yourself, now all of us have different stories. Some of us had broken homes. Some of us had maybe legalistic parents, and we thought of judgment scares you. But you're going to give an account to a holy God who loves you and died for you. That changes everything. And the righteous requirements of the law are fulfilled in you. That being said, organize your life for that unavoidable moment. And so you say, well, I was born in New York State. All right, so I'm going to run through this. This is what I did, and this is why I'm directing my activities this way. Do them in the Lord. And if you've sinned, if you're doing this right now, and this is causing you some great trepidation, go confess your sins to him. 1 John 1:9. Okay? And you have the power, as Donald Gray Barnhouse says, the power in your life over sin is much like the Israelites crossing through the Red Sea. The power of gravity was pulling that water down upon them, but the great grace of that east wind kept that water back. And that is the life that we're living right now, where the gravity of sin is in the law wants to crash down upon us. But we have the grace of God, the power of grace. So the law of the spirit of life is like that east wind holding all that water back. And what did the water do when the people of grace, the covenant grace, passed through it? It drowned the non-covenant people. So we all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. So when you're reading death in Ecclesiastes, death is not just a grave in the sense where that's it. I had a Jehovah Witness come one day and they don't stop by my house anymore. And really, I regret that. Because I try to go out and see them in my neighborhood. I'm trying to, hey, want to talk? Nobody wants to talk to me. I don't know. I get a reputation. But of course, they don't believe in hell. Basically, God's going to give you like an eternal anesthetic. Kind of clunky in the head. No, that's not a God you fear. Who cares? There's no hell. There's no ultimate justice. If death is just an eternal unconsciousness, think about all the evils that the preacher's speaking of. And you see throughout history in the Bible, if he's not angry with that, he's not God. And how would you make sense of why Christ goes to the cross for us? That birth, in that lowly birth, with a bunch of animals, right? And the path that Mary had to take, pregnant, many months pregnant, whether walking or on a donkey or what have you. These are difficult things. This is a difficult world. And the preacher is not denying those things. He wants us to look at them for what they are. He continues, all the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. An interesting thing here, that the word appetite is translated, can be translated soul. Leopold points that out. Either way, there's no getting away from the fact, he says, Leopold says, from the fact that it's the soul which has the appetite. So it's a fascinating thing that the drive to this happiness, this drive for this meaning, eternity has been written on our hearts, our souls, this drive is not ever going to be satisfied outside of God. There's something seriously wrong. You see that if you know anybody that's an artist, a musician, a writer, and they're like the Charlie Brown Christmas special, that great piece of art, incidentally, where what was the basic theme? The commercialization of Christmas. Big, good artists and writers and so forth don't like the commercialization of something. They realize it ought to be pure, but they can't quite figure it out. There's a pull between commerce, marketing, having to make a living, having to pay the rent, keep the power on, and producing good art. That's the conflict of the soul, the appetite, all of this work we have to do to keep ourselves alive. And sometimes do we resent it? You know, do we resent having to do some of the things we have to do to make a living? Yeah, that's what he's saying. So the appetite is not satisfied. We crave satisfaction, can't find it. And the preacher would use this, if we'll listen, to show us that we're made for God. That this dissatisfaction, this disquiet, is evidence that we need to go to him. It should bring us to prayer and the word, which are, like today, is a foretaste of the age to come. We'll be banging around the streets of eternal Jerusalem, maybe bumping into Hulk Hogan. That's pretty cool. Right? With no more sin and no more fear. Will you live for that? Or will you live for the momentary pleasures that are passing away? So for what advantage has the wise man over the fool? And what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is vanity and striving after wind. Did he just say that wisdom is why write Proverbs? What's going on with this? Why would Jesus Christ be the wisdom of God? That can't be true. Remember, we always take all of Scripture and put it on a particular text. Avoid any type of misinterpretations here. What he's saying is, who really knows how to conduct themselves before the world? Who does? God's covenant people. They have the commandments and the statutes of the Lord and the ordinances of the Lord. The law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. Right? That's what he's talking about. So he's talking about the covenant people have God's ordinances. And yet, they'd be enticed by the wandering of the appetite. Again, let's take our temperature. You keep thinking about what you'd like to have. And Christmas is tomorrow, and there's going to be a bunch of people who are going to get something they've wanted for a long, 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 long time. And by Tuesday or Wednesday, they don't really care. The preacher's warning against that. Take your temperature, Christian. Where is your heart? Where is your heart? Greed and envy are indeed alive in the hearts of even God's children. And so we're warned. We can't serve God and money. Where our treasure is, there is our heart also. Godliness with contentment is the goal of Christian living. To be content with the Lord and our work directed towards him, and with a decided focus upon him, not our riches. Let him determine how much we have, not, oh, I gotta have this. I know a small business owner that is determined that he wants to make X number of millions a year in his business now. And that's been causing some turmoil. That's been causing some turmoil because it's an arbitrary goal based on an arbitrary number in God's world. So, whatever has come to be has already been named, and it is known what man is. And he's not able to dispute with one stronger than he. Job wanted to debate the Lord. As Dr. Phil would say, how'd that work out for you? you're not gonna dispute with the Lord. I mean, this is an understated thing of don't get into a fight with the Almighty. All right? The best thing to say is what Joshua does outside Jericho. Kneel down. What does the Lord say to his servant? Stop bickering with him. You know the power of prayer is when you go to the Lord and you're just delighted to be talking to the Lord. Whether he gives you what you think you want or not, you're more concerned with him and the relationship than you are with getting your way. You go and you honestly plead with him. You can honestly tell him, this is terrible. I don't like this. May this cup pass from me. But the basic premise is that whatever you do is going to be good, and I know that. Help me to see it. That's godly prayer with contentment. If you go into dispute with them, again, I think complaining against God's sovereignty is man's full pastime. They say baseball is America's pastime. No, disputing with God's sovereignty is man's pastime. Man is a cosmic rebel against his creator God, and that's what's known. That's what man is. We're a cosmic rebel. And this is a very nice way of saying that he will indubitably lose that war unless he repents and turns to Christ. What weapon do you have to beat the cherubim with the flaming sword? None. Right? Okay? As a self-defense instructor, I always remind people, if you know you're going to lose a battle, you really need to be thinking escape the whole way. That's pretty much plain. Then he says, the more words, the more vanity. And what is advantage to man? Another point to ponder. In our sin, we have no weapons upon which we may retake that gate at Eden. Our response, since we can't dispute with the Lord, talk. Lots of it. Lots of books. Lots of TED Talks. Right? Lots of all this stuff. Man's wisdom everywhere. The great deceivers are the great destroyers. Look at Lenin. Look at the Germans decided to get Lenin. Lenin was in exile, to get him back into Russia. They spent millions and millions and millions of dollars because they figured if Lenin gets back in Russia, Russia will fall and they're out of the war and Germany wins. How'd that work out for Germany? God is sovereign. No matter what you plan outside of the Lord, it's going to work. Look at Jonah. I'm not going to Nineveh. I don't like those people. So he paid for a ticket, went that way, didn't make it. You try to go away from the Lord, you'll pay the ticket. You still won't get there. You go where the Lord wants. Remember, he got to Nineveh. That's where he was going. He didn't pay the airfare or the ship fee, the cruise fee. The fish did. He didn't get there the way he wanted to get there, but he got there because God will not be argued with. He will win. Right? Think about what Abraham does. Far be it from me. I'm sorry. I'm not really understanding what you're doing with this whole thing. But ashes and dust, really sorry. Almighty God, really sorry. But what if there's like 50 good people? Will you destroy the whole city? See the humility in that? And the concern and compassion for people? Okay, if there's 50, I won't destroy it. I'm sorry to bother you again. That should be our petitions. Remember who you're talking to. Don't think this is like you barge into his office and, hey, dude, you need to hear me. I'm man, hear me roar. Okay? Last thing with this. For who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? A few days. He doesn't mince words. I think it's funny. I come from a background where, I mean, I'm used to hard truths. I'm not used to the sugarcoating. I'm used to hard truth. Just spit it out. Pull that, rip that thing out, okay? Our lives are brutally short. We should take stock. And not only do we not know what's coming, he doesn't mean what's coming after you, after you're dead, who has your house and the whole nine yards. He's talking tomorrow. You have no idea. I saw that the Fed Treasury, Mr. Powell, decided to halt the interest rate stuff for next year. And the Wall Street Journal and all their wisdom was rather shocked by the whole thing. And I was preparing, I was like chuckling about that. You don't know what's going on. You don't know what's going on. We don't know what's going to happen. All of us must give an account someday before the Lord, as we said. Whether we live or whether we die, we are the Lord's, because it's the Lord's world. And if live is in a way where we make it seem it's not his world, is the most irrational thing that we can do. It's like a passing shadow, so don't be lazy nor presumptive, is the preacher's point. Who can tell what will happen tomorrow? That's meant to humble us and bring us to him, not to leave us in despair. Nobody knows anything. He does. And we know him. And when something's going wrong, we go to him in that humble prayer and petition. I will pause there. I think that is the end of Ecclesiastes 6, 1 through 12. I do hope it was a blessing and the Lord uses it. I'll turn back over to Bobby.